Chapter 39. Marin 9. The sovereign must hold himself to a higher standard than the citizen. His path is one of poise, of control, and of sobriety. When his people feast, he must remain watchful for enemies. When his people sleep, he must remain alert for danger. He must never allow his honor to be compromised, because his actions are the actions of a country. His honor is their honor. This is generous, to act as normal men wish they could. Marin paced in the monastery reading room, its smaller confines well fitting his agitated mood. The monk, in his simple gray sencoat and tan trousers, read calmly from The Way of Kings. Though the man undoubtedly noticed Marin's state, he refrained from making any commentary. He simply read according to his duty, acting as an unbiased conduit for the ancient text. Marin would have welcomed a little advice at the moment. Unfortunately, he was becoming accustomed enough to noble propriety to realize this was not an issue to discuss with a random monastery brother. And so he paced, hoping Badgerden's wisdom would stretch through the epics to tell Marin what he should do.
"Read that part again," Marin said, pausing.
"The sovereign must hold himself accountable to laws that normal men may ignore," the monk said dutifully. "It is only by living a higher path himself that he can ask his people to obey his dictates." Marin nodded, beginning his pacing again as the brother continued on. As Marin moved, his eye caught sight of the room's corner where his shard blade sat leaning against the wall, Dalinar's cloak draped over its hilt. "The sovereign must hold himself accountable to laws that normal men may ignore." Marin was no sovereign, no king or Parthian, and yet he was a nobleman. Bajardin's words were addressed to him. Marin had assumed he understood. He'd wanted to be a hero, wanted it so badly. His dreams had been of shard blades and great acts of courage, his mind stuffed with evening stories told when the day's harvest was in. He had been prepared for hardship. The stories always spoke of the soreness of marching or that of sleeping on rock. Things were never easy for the great warriors. Their horses died, their friends betrayed them, and they always got caught outside during high storms. He had been prepared to be hurt, perhaps to die. The heroes didn't always win. Some, like poor Tanath of Kanar, died bravely, but died nonetheless. Marin continued his pacing. Why hadn't any of the stories prepared him for this? What of the guilt that came from doing what you thought was right, then realizing afterward that you might have been wrong? What was the right answer? He had let Arador go. A braver man would have gone with his friend, joining him in a just but unpopular cause. A more honorable man would have sent word to Lord Dalinar, warning of the heir's flight. Perhaps if Marin had done that, the riders sent to chase Arador down would have been successful. Yet faced with these two options, Marin had done nothing. He hadn't gone with Arador, and he hadn't informed Lord Dalinar. His inaction made him feel non-existent. The world continued as if Marin weren't involved. But wasn't that a good thing? Who was he to interfere with the workings of great men? "The sovereign must hold himself accountable to laws that normal men may ignore." That was the problem. Faced with two choices, both honorable in their own light, Marin had done nothing. "But," he thought with frustration, "what could I have done? Sent messengers to Lord Dalinar, thereby betraying Arador? Left to try and protect Arador, thereby breaking my oaths to Lord Dalinar?" Honor was supposed to be absolute. Of this single fact, the stories were firm. There was good, and there was evil. Was Marin flawed because he couldn't tell the two apart? He wasn't really a nobleman, after all. He was just a peasant with a shard blade. He couldn't help thinking that a better man in his same position would have instinctively known what to do. They did. Dalinar and Arador. They both knew their courses, and they chose opposite paths. But they're both good men. Could a good man choose a dishonorable action? The monk had stopped reading. Merrin paused, looking up. They must have reached the end of the fourth section of the Way of Kings already.
You may go, Merrin said.
He'd kept the man far too long already, and Bajardin's words didn't seem like they were helping all that much. Merrin had gone through the entire book nearly a 10 set times during the last week, and he was no closer to a solution. Merrin sighed, gathering up his blade and throwing on his cloak. Outside, the hallways of Gloryhome Monastery were broad, almost daunting. Great archways covered massive and intricate glyph renderings, constructed with silvers, golds, and gemstones so that they glistened in the sunlight. Merrin passed near one, his form blocking the window's light and throwing a shadow over the majestic wall inlay. It was designed vaguely in the shape of the double eye, but it was crafted from what looked to be hundreds, maybe even thousands, of glyphs. He ran his eyes along the patterns, looking for forms he recognized. There were a few familiar glyphs, but not the one he sought. He suspected he would never again see his phantom glyph, the strange carving that had granted him such power. The stories and old gaffers often spoke of mystical glyph wards imbued with power. They were always ancient and rare things, like in the tale of the Tenth Dawn with its pig-herding hero. Merrin had found such a glyph of power, but had wasted its energies in one furious moment. He could still feel the winds charging down the palace hallway, screaming in his ears, obeying his desperate plea. Such strength! If only he could remember the exact construction of the glyph. Perhaps he could recreate its power, if only in some small way. But his attempts so far had been laughable, and he dare not show them to anyone else, for they smacked too closely of writing. Merrin shook his head. Such powers were for awakeners and mystics. It had been marvelous fortune that one had found its way to him, even for a short time. In fact, it was probably better that it was gone. Such things were not meant for simple boys like Merrin. It had belonged to the faceless shard-bearer, a charm intended for the workings of some great deed.
A deed I foiled, Merrin thought. The assassination of King Elokar. That glyph ward was meant for foul deeds, Merrin. Yes, it is much better lost.
In the end, instead of killing the king, the glyph ward had served to save the man's life.
I stare at them too sometimes, Renarin's voice said from behind.
Merrin turned as Renarin walked up beside him. The younger Kolin's son stood with his eyes focused on the massive glyph rendering.
Even when I was a boy, I was more interested in the patterns on monastery walls and floors than I was in the sermons of the monks.
Renarin reached up, brushing a line of silver inlay with his fingers, as if searching through touch for some meaning that his eyes could not detect. Finally, he turned to Merrin.
How was your recitation from the Way of Kings?
Frustrating, Merrin replied. What about you? How was your recitation of,
Beyond the Wall of Essence, Renarin explained. And yes, it was interesting, though it's a 7th epic work, and some of the language is difficult to understand. You should have it read to you sometime, especially if you're interested in lonomic theory.
Merrin nodded, though he had little interest in the esoteric works Renarin studied. The basic texts were confusing enough. Merrin turned to go, moving down the hallway toward the monastery exit. Renarin's eyes lingered on the massive glyph rendering, but he did follow. Merrin stepped out into the sunlight. Gloryhome was very different from the other two monasteries in Kolinar. It was constructed on the side of the late valley, a moderate hike from the city proper. Renarin explained that Ishar monks, the order named after the herald who had written the arguments, tended to prefer seclusion. Gloryhome's hallways were always quiet, and there were no courtyards for dueling practice. just seemingly endless rooms filled with books, scrolls, and reading pedestals. They began to walk the switchbacks leading down to Kolinar, Marin's mind brooding over the same old problems. The morning chill had burned away as the sun crested the valley walls, and the summer heat was powerful. That only served to increase his taxed feeling of fatigue.
"Do you wonder if we did the right thing, Renarin?" he asked as they walked.
"It is a man's way to wonder,"
Renarin replied. Marin sighed, rolling his eyes slightly. Unfortunately, Renarin was the only one he could talk to about the topic.
"Well, do you find any answers when you wonder?"
"I assume you're talking about my brother,"
Renarin said. Marin nodded. Renarin walked for a moment before speaking again.
"I don't know, Marin," he finally said. "I don't think it would have been right to try and stop him. You saw how he was that week before he left. This is something he needed to do."
"And if he dies out there?" Marin asked. "If he is killed in the war, won't his death be partially upon us, since we didn't do our duty by stopping him?"
Renarin shrugged.
"I don't know."
"How can you be so ambivalent?" Marin demanded with frustration. "This is your brother we're talking about. If we had been the ones leaving for war, Arador would have gone with us. You know he would have. Arador would have insisted on accompanying us, if only to protect us from harm. But we let him go alone."
Renarin fell silent. Eventually, he just sighed.
"You think I haven't considered these things, Marin? You think I haven't stood in the night staring east, wondering what Arador is doing, if he's all right? I've seen you brooding these last few days. Well, you're not the first one to worry. People always whisper about me in court, about how I'm always thinking about things no one else cares about. Well, I think about things I care about. And let me promise you, if it involves Arador's flight, I've considered it. Far harder and far longer than you probably have."
Marin recoiled slightly at the outburst, spoken in Renarin's usual near monotone, yet snappish nonetheless. A moment later, Renarin turned toward him, a bit of the hostility draining from his posture.
"I'm sorry, Marin," he said. "I wish I could answer you. It seems I'm having enough trouble answering my own questions lately. I've always been able to see things, answer problems that no one else can. But now, when it finally matters, I can't find anything but more questions. I don't know where to find the answers to any of them."
Marin looked down, feeling a bit ashamed. If Renarin had tried that hard and was still confused, what chance did Marin have of finding the answers? If only... Marin looked up. The city was approaching, and from their vantage he could make out much of its sprawl, including several distinctive buildings.
"Renarin doesn't know where to find the answers."
"I think I do," Marin said. "Come on."
The Ilinra temples confused Marin. For the most part, the nobility ignored the Ilinra, and what little they did say about the religious sects was always scornful. That felt odd to Marin, since in other areas of faith, the nobility were quick to prove how righteous they were. During his months in Kolinar, Marin had been able to discover a bit of what made the Ilinra unpopular. The 10 heraldic sects were connected in the noble mind to the common man, but not in the same way as the Order of Khonra monks, who spend their time serving the poor and the feeble. No, the Ilinra were considered something that only citizens participated in, something beneath noble attention. There also seemed to be some sense that the Ilinra were unorthodox, even profane, though Marin couldn't understand how that would be. The Ilinra worshipped the heralds and the Almighty just like Voronism. They were parts of the same religion. Renarin balked at the temple entrance.
"I don't think we should be doing this, Marin."
"Why not?" Marin asked. "Ilinra soothsayers came through my village all the time, and everyone agreed that they were useful. They predicted the floods during my 12th year, and one told my mother she was pregnant before she even knew. My father always got their advice to decide which day to begin the planting or harvest."
"That's superstition, Marin,"
Renarin said.
"The Almighty doesn't work like that. Giving his truths to whispering soothsayers and mystics?"
"Why not?" Marin asked. "Doesn't he want us to know what to do? The arguments say he loves us, right? So he'd want us to ask him what to do." We ask for blessings through the monasteries, Renarin said. Marin rolled his eyes. This is the same thing. Come on, I'll show you. If the Alinra were evil, would your father let them into his city? I don't think he has much choice, Renarin said. They're too popular to keep out. He looked up, staring at the statue of Prael Smokewish, Herald of Secrets. The statue depicted a dynamic figure, a tall, lean man who was bare-chested beneath his sencoat. The herald's right arm was upraised, fingers curled as if grasping an unseen object. The head pointed east toward the dawn, and the left hand held a stone shard blade.
I've never liked that statue, Renarin said. I don't imagine Prael Ilin like that. He's too imposing to be a scholar.
Are you coming in or not? Marin prodded. Renarin finally sighed, climbing the steps and joining Marin. Marin nodded, trying to look more confident than he was. In truth, he didn't have much of an idea how to proceed. Where he came from, the Ilinra didn't have grand temples or beautiful statues. Ilinra priests were humble-clothed men who traveled the villages making auguries or giving blessings. And while most towns had Ilinra fraternities, Marin had been too young to join their clandestine meetings. Yet he had come this far. Surely the Ilinra here gave auguries like the priests did in the villages. The entry chamber was dark, lit only by strange lanterns that were covered in dark blue glass encasings. The flames flickered as things distant, their light frail. Several figures in dark gray or perhaps dark blue robes stood in conference at one side of the room. As soon as they noticed Marin and Renarin, however, one of the men scuttled forward with a quick step.
"My lords," he said eagerly, his excited voice echoing strangely in the gloomy room. "Welcome, welcome. I am called Camp. Have you come for blessing, wisdom, or augury?"
"Augury," Marin said.
"Ah, excellent, my lords," the man said with a friendly bow.
He took special note of Marin's blade, then squinted at Renarin's face and paled slightly.
"Why, Lord Colin," he exclaimed, "this is a rare honor."
"It is a rare time," Renarin replied with a frown.
"What kind of augury do you require, my lords?" the man asked. "Of the sands, of the wines, or of the warts?"
Marin only recognized one.
"Warts," he replied. "Very good. Please, if you will, there is an augury room to your right. I shall fetch you a seer."
Camp nodded toward a small chamber at the side of the entryway, then scuttled away and disappeared into a darkened corridor.
Bit cheery for an evil cultist, Renarin noted, frown still in place.
Marin snorted, leading the way toward the augury chamber.
"Ilinra is no cult," he snapped. "It's just another part of Bornism. Honestly, there's even a herald outside."
Renarin didn't respond, instead allowing himself to be led into the side room. It was oblong with a carved double eye on the floor. In the center of the eye, sitting on top of the glyphs Kav and Dal, was a stone table with a bench along one side and a stool on the other. Three of the blue lanterns hung along the sides of the room, and silver glyphs were carved almost ostentatiously along the walls. They were neither as beautiful nor as intricate as the glyphs in the temple, more like background decorations than actual pieces of art. A few minutes later, Camp returned, leading an elderly man by the arm. The old man looked fairly unhappy to need the assistance and held his head high, an attempt at dignity slightly undermined by his faltering step. As soon as the two reached the stool, the old man swiped at the younger priest's arm.
"I'm quite fine on my own," he snapped in a grumbling voice,
seating himself. Camp didn't let go of the old man's arm until he was completely situated, however, an action that earned him another swipe. The old priest composed himself, gnarled hands resting on the table as he eyed Marin and Renarin in the soft light.
"I don't recognize them," he said.
"They're here for an augury, grandfather," Camp said, voice lighthearted despite the treatment he had received. "Noble men,"
The distinguished man on the left is Lord Renarin Colin, son of our great Lord Dalinar. And unless I guess incorrectly, our other guest is Lord Merin Colin, he who saved the king's life on 2 different occasions. They are very important men. The old man snorted.
What do they want?
An augury, Camp reminded gently. The old man closed one eye, leaning forward to examine Merin a little closer. Then he grunted and bent down, teetering precariously for a moment, and hefted a small bag up from underneath the table and placed it on the table. He began working at its knots with 2 sets of gnarled fingers, a task that took him no small amount of effort. However, he swatted Camp's hands away every time the younger man reached to help. "Grandfather is one of our finest seers," Camp said as the old man finally pulled free the knot and began removing a set of worn wooden discs, the width of a man's fist. "They say that wisdom and age brings great power in seership, and that a man who—"
"Shut up!"
the old man snapped. He eyed Merin and Renarin again.
"Who's paying?"
Merin paused.
"I will, Holy One. How much is the usual donation?"
"It's not a donation, it's a payment," the old man said. "And it's 50 ishmarks."
Renarin snorted at the extravagant price, but Merin removed a sapphire of the appropriate value and set it on the table. Sight of the large gem finally made the old man perk up, and he shook himself slightly, adopting a more formal air. His fingers moved with a bit more dexterity, bespeaking a familiarity as Camp handed him a large sheet of paper, which the old man proceeded to put down over the table's top. Merin frowned, sitting back as the man flattened the large sheet, then set 5 candles at the table corners. This part was unfamiliar to Merin. The other seers had only drawn the discs from a bag, using the symbols on them to make predictions. Once the paper was flat, the old man arranged the wooden discs into several piles, all face down, their glyphs hidden.
"Your name?"
the old man asked.
"Merin," Merin said. "Merin Colin."
The man reached into his bag again, riffling through a group of stones inscribed with glyphs. He selected one, the one inscribed with Riem, the basis for Merin's name, then set it at the very center of the table.
"Day of birth?"
the old man demanded, distractedly pulling out a piece of black charcoal and scribbling a few numbers beside the stone at the center.
10th day of Mornul," Merin said.
The old man paused.
"A portentous day indeed," he said.
He looked back at the paper, holding his charcoal and frowning slightly.
"Merin," he mumbled, "Riem, Ezer, Rosh, Ish."
77, Camp said helpfully. The old man hissed, swatting at the younger priest with a twisted hand. Then he proceeded to scribble the number beside the others.
"All forces, no essences. Another portent. You are a strange child indeed."
Merin blushed slightly, beginning to feel embarrassed. This wasn't what he had expected at all. He glanced at Renarin, expecting to be confronted with skeptical eyes. The younger Colin, however, sat with an interested posture, watching the old man's markings with unblinking eyes.
"Numbers," Merin realized. "Should have known those would interest him."
"And so,"
the old man said, studying Merin,
"why do you seek an augury, Merin Colin, he who was birthed on a 10th day and named after the forces?"
"We seek news of a friend," Merin answered. "A friend we fear lost."
"This friend's name?"
"Arador," Merin said. "Arador Colin."
"Ah,"
the old man said, exhaling slowly.
"Should have guessed that one, eh? Very well."
He reached into his sack again, pulling free a stone inscribed with the glyph Shal, and set it on the table.
"Would you know his date of birth?"
"The 39th of Marshin," Renarin said.
The old man nodded, scribbling numbers around Arador's stone as well. Once finished, he reached into his bag one last time and picked out a larger, perfectly round stone with no markings on it. The others had been of some kind of granite,
but this was a pure black, probably onyx.
"It is in order,"
the old man finally said, holding the onyx sphere in his left hand.
"You may begin turning over the chips, one from each of the 5 piles."
Marin nodded, reaching forward and turning over the first wooden disc. This was more what he had expected.
"Ah,"
the old man said.
"Khor, time and age. What is the next disc? Shall? I see. Pause for a moment."
Marin frowned, waiting as the man scribbled more on the tabletop, forming a cascading sequence of numbers from one stone to the other.
"Not good. Not good,"
he mumbled.
"I see danger. Danger indeed for the heir, Colin. Yes, danger and fighting. The next chip."
It was Riem, the symbol of unchangingness. This set the old man into a flurry of scribbling and mumbling.
"Danger?" Marin asked with a frown. "That's it? Of course there's danger. He rides to war."
"Patience!"
the old man snapped, idly rolling the onyx sphere in his left hand.
"You have to give the numbers time."
Marin sat back with a huff. Renarin, however, continued to lean forward. He stood slightly, bending over the table and watching the old seers work. The old man eyed Renarin with annoyance.
"Next disc,"
he said testily.
"Jez,"
Marin said, after turning it over. The old man said, scribbling.
"I see a difficult passage of time for House Colin. I see divisions and storms and—"
"And would you sit back down?"
Renarin didn't respond. He stood with his face pressed nearly to the table, eyes scrambling across the old man's numeric equations.
"This is wrong," Renarin whispered. "You leave holes, such big holes, and you wander like a man lost, or one who cannot see."
"Cannot see?"
the old man demanded, swatting ineffectually at Renarin.
"I've been a seer for 6 decades. Numerology takes time, practice, and age. What do you know of it?"
Renarin ignored him.
"But I can't see either," he said. "You write the questions even more crudely than I, and you have no answers. You—"
He trailed off, glancing upward toward the old man's left hand and the sphere clutched therein. Both hands moved at once. Renarin, however, was far more spry. Moving with a dexterity Marin would have envied in the dueling ring, Renarin snatched the onyx sphere from the old man's hand.
"This is insufferable,"
the old man said, swatting Renarin repeatedly with the empty sack. Renarin took the opportunity to grab the man's discarded charcoal stick. The old seer hissed indignantly and stood.
"My pride is offended. You tempt both winds and even the Almighty's heralds themselves. May the answerer himself bring you ruin."
He ignored his grandson's pleas, waving the young man away and beginning to hobble away from the table. He paused, however, then turned back and grabbed Marin's sapphire. Then he huffed one last time and lurched his way from the room. Camp followed with a worried look, shooting a bow back at Marin and Renarin before disappearing after the old man.
"Well, that was brilliant," Marin snapped. "It would help sometimes, Renarin, if you would try to be a little less strange. You even scared away an Alinra priest."
"Hush," Renarin said, eyes still on the table. He began to scribble on the paper, sweeping the wooden chips out of his way with a dismissive gesture. The discs flew from the table, knocking a candle to the floor and spraying wax across the dark blue stone.
"Renarin?"
Marin asked, standing and frowning slightly at the intensity in his friend's eyes. Renarin ignored him, scribbling a few more numbers. He paused, looking down at the onyx in his hand, eyes awed. Then he turned back to the numbers.
"By the winds," Renarin whispered, almost as if in a trance. "He's going to die, Marin. Arador, he's going to die." "What?" Marin asked. "Renarin, you can't know that."
"I see it, Marin," said the younger Colin. "It's here. Finally, I can see. Ardor is going to die fighting the king. Jezenrosh will lose. If only father had stopped him. but Arador went the other way. North, not east. By river, not by land.
Renarin paused, then looked up at Meryn, eyes mournful.
He's doomed. My brother is doomed.
Meryn shivered.
Renarin, I...
He trailed off as a group of priests in blue robes appeared at the door, their expressions agitated.
My lords, one of them asserted, perhaps it would be best if you left now.
Renarin's head snapped up. Sweat streamed down his brow, and he stared at the men with a disturbing frenzy. He began to shake slightly, like a man about to have a fit.
Yes, we should leave, Meryn said quickly.
So much for the augury, he thought, regarding Renarin with worry. Come on, Renarin. Renarin held up the onyx sphere.
How much for the stone? He demanded.
My lord?
The stocky priest asked.
What do you want for it?
Renarin asked.
What does it cost?
My lord, the stone of Asir is...
The man stopped as Renarin pulled out his cloak pouch and spread its contents across the table. 3 10-set coins glistened beneath the 4 remaining candles, an array of colors, rubicon, hyacinthine, and azure.
That will be enough,
the priest said, eyes wide.
Enough also to forgive the incident this day,
Meryn said, pushing Renarin from the room.
Lord Renarin has been of a strange temperament recently. The stress of his brother's disappearance has been great.
Of course, my lord,
the priest said, still staring at the table's riches. Meryn led Renarin from the temple, and the bright light seemed to restore a bit of his friend's sanity. Renarin blinked, shading his eyes from the sun, the onyx sphere still clutched in his hand. He stood for a moment, then sighed, looking down.
I'm all right,
he said, noticing Marin's concerned look.
Let's get back to the palace and have something to eat, Meryn said.
Renarin still looked a bit pale, his skin clammy. Renarin nodded.
I feel so strange.
That means a lot, coming from you, Meryn said, trying a wan levity. Renarin, however, didn't smile. He shook his head.
I feel it still, Meryn. Arador is going to die.
I worry about him too, Meryn said.
No, Meryn. I know he is going to die.
Meryn eyed his friend, looking for signs of another... whatever had happened before. Renarin looked to be his old self, however, though he was even more gloomy than normal. He remained that way through the entire walk back to the palace, though Meryn tried to get him to talk about other topics, anything but Arador. It didn't work. And as they walked, Meryn found Renarin's thoughts contagious. His uncertainty from before returned, his worries released from their brief captivity. He was no closer to knowing what he should do. He had still abandoned Arador, and he had still broken with duty by not telling Lord Dalinar what he knew. At their rooms again, Meryn ordered them a simple meal, hoping the sustenance would do Renarin some good. The boy quickly found his balcony, however, and stood upon it brooding. Meryn felt little better.
I need to make a decision one way or the other, he realized. It's the indecision that is destroying me.
He felt like Arador had looked that week before making the decision to leave. But what decision to make?
What if there's another answer?
Renarin, he said, standing. What was that you said about Arador before? Going north, not east?
When he left, Renarin said idly, Arador said no horse would catch him, even though he knew that Father had taken all of the fastest horses with him for the messengers to use. Arador shouldn't have been able to stay ahead. Not when Father had all the best stock. Yet he did. Father never found him. That's because Arador didn't take a path anyone expected. He went north, then took the river east.
But the river doesn't flow strongly enough to carry traffic in the summer, Meryn said. Renarin shook his head.
I saw it, Meryn. That's what he did. I don't know how, but he did it.
Meryn opened his mouth to object, but paused. Long ago, just after Meryn had been given his shard blade, Arador had told him something about Renarin. He notices things, Meryn. Things regular people just don't see. I've rarely known him to be wrong.
We need to go after him, Renarin, Meryn announced.
Renarin looked up.
We can't, he said. My father. We have no choice, Marin said. Look at us. We can't stay here, worrying like this. He's your brother and my friend. We can't let him die alone.
Renarin stood quietly.
We won't fight, though,
Marin explained, stepping closer and speaking quietly.
We'll leave in secret, like Arador, and follow him. Then, when we get there, we'll convince him to come back. We won't disobey Lord Dalinor's command, but we also won't break Arador's trust.
We won't be able to convince him, Renarin said. And besides, my father commanded that no one go to the war at all. We'll be breaking his command if we leave without his permission.
We'll break the command, but not the honor of it, Marin said. Renarin, I can't stay here anymore. I have to go. This worrying is driving us both mad. It will work out. The Almighty will see to that.
Renarin didn't look convinced.
Would you rather stay behind? Marin asked.
Renarin looked up, then shook his head.
Let's go then, quickly, before I think about it too much.